PDIS? What does that mean? What is that?
Yeah, PDIS. It's people doing interesting stuff.
Oh. Well, who's the host? Who's going to host it?
I'm going to host it. Samuel Roberts. I'm the host.
Get out of here, man. You ain't serious. You serious?
Yeah. What? Yeah, I'm serious. Yeah, man. Oh, man.
Oh. Okay. All right, cool.
One other important element to the idea of a new harm reduction program was the belief, and it was my belief, that the best people to do this work were people who came from the same communities and the same background and had similar experiences to the individuals that we were trying to help. So that's why we call it a community, that our staff have been in the same seat, so to speak, or the same predicaments as the people who come to the programs, and they have managed to transcend many of the issues and the problems. And so just their presence working in the program, helping us to facilitate their program, just their presence and their own experience of having overcome many of their own challenges had the ability to ignite hope in the individuals who were coming to arrive. And the ignition of hope is a spiritual quality that is so important. You know, because the person who's been down and out and just getting out of prison and maybe on his way or her way to getting strung out again looks at that person and says, well, if they can do it, I can do it too.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to PDIS, People Doing Interesting Stuff. I'm Samuel Roberts. In the late 1980s, Howard Josepher and Joe Turner get together in New York City and begin the program, which is today known as Exponents. The goal was deceptively simple. It was basically to establish an outreach and recovery program for people returning home from prison and who had substance use problems. As you might imagine, though, it was a lot more complicated than that. They started off with some federal funding to run a 3-year program. When that money dried up, they were left with this program, which had a lot of promise, but very few resources. And compounding all that, by the way, is that there really weren't that many existing models for the kind of work that they were doing. Many of their early participants had been diagnosed with HIV. This was back when such a diagnosis was, you know, very close to being a death sentence. It was, you know, not nearly as manageable as it is today. All of them used drugs and were at risk for contracting the virus. Parole programs back then weren't that helpful. Addiction programs all required abstinence above all else to be, you know, eligible for the services. And then you get Howie and Joe, who have this vision of harm reduction-based recovery, which emphasized stability and wellness first, not abstinence. And it's just really ahead of its time. And, you know, the model they still use is the one they use now is the one they've always had. They start off with, you know, an 8-week course that helps people just begin that recovery process. They're not promising, you know, a cure in 28 days, or they're not doing tough love, they're not doing, you know, so many other things that, you know, work for some people but don't work for a lot of people. They're just trying to get people in the door to reach out and give them some options. Fast forward 30 years later almost, they're known all over the country, all over the world. There's some 10,000 plus graduates from their program, which is called ARRIVE, and they're known everywhere. 75% of their enrollees complete the program and they go into recovery. In fact, I think all of their 40-odd staff members are all graduates of the program themselves. So, and they've expanded in terms of counseling and support, homeless services. They do have an addiction treatment program. They do peer training. They do HIV testing, hepatitis, HCV outreach and services, outreach to sex workers, recovery support, GD training, and what they started off with, which was the pre-release and reentry services for returning citizens. It was a fun interview, challenging at times, because they are so ahead of a lot of what a lot of us think about recovery, but it was a lot of fun to sit down with them in December of 2017 to talk to them about how they got together and how they got it all started. I hope you enjoy it. This is PDIS, People Doing Interesting Stuff. I'm Samuel Roberts.
All right. Let's take a look at our levels here. I'm going to do... You guys just keep talking. I'm going to adjust.
Okay.
Can you hear yourselves?
Yes, I can hear myself.
I can hear Mike.
Right. Yeah, I can hear you through the microphone. Hey, Howie.
Joe.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to WEXP, your late-night entertainment.
Hey, you got a voice for radio, Joe.
Right, right.
And with us is Joe Turner from WFIX.
Thank you, Howard.
And we are recording, indeed. How's it going, gentlemen?
Just fine, Sam.
Glad I made it down here. You see how long it took me to get this this equipment together.
Yeah.
It's a lot going on here. I'm still getting the hang of it, too, to be honest.
Yeah, I would say you would have some shoulder problems pretty soon with all this.
Well, see, what I got to do is find an intern is what I need.
Right.
You know, someone who can work for free. But until that moment, I'm my own pack mule here. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. I know you guys are really busy. It's good to see you all. And I'm really glad you guys could be on the show. Why don't we, let's start with some basics. Where are we right now?
We are at Exponents, a community-based organization in New York City that helps people with drug problems, people re-entering society from prison or jail. We do HIV prevention and care, and also other issues in terms of the communities that we serve, which are generally poorer communities with issues like drug addiction and infectious disease. And we provide a number of different programs for people to help them to make better choices, take better care of themselves and their families.
And Howie, you're executive director, and Joe, you're vice president. Did I get the title right on that?
Yes.
And you're both the co-founders of Exponents.
Yes.
How many, I know you all years ago started kind of small, but right now you guys are living large. How many members do you have these days? More or less. I mean, I don't. Actually, you know what? Now that I think about it, I'm not even sure how you count members because you all have, you graduate people in cohorts.
Yeah.
So I imagine you probably count all of your graduates as members of a sort, right?
Right. Well, actually, I think we refer to them as participants.
Right.
That are they're engaged in one of our 14 different programs. I think as of now. Our flagship program, the ARRIVE program, which started many moons ago, in 1988, that is a time-limited program, 8 weeks in duration. And the graduates from that program, we started out, I believe, with five, Howie, in 1988?
Seven. Five.
And five graduated, right, five graduated. And so from 1988... to 2017, we've had over 10,500 graduates.
Wow.
So, you know, when Howie said community-based, I said, yes, we are, you know, we see ourselves as a community-based agency because, as Howie pointed out, our population is that population. But we're not just restricted to our physical location down here in the financial district. And I think when we say community, we're also building community, you know, a larger community of people in recovery,
right.
People with compromised immune systems. So I just thought about that it's well said that we are community-based, you know, community growing and community engendering. So,
and what is, I think... ARRIVE, I mean, you all are known for a lot of things. I think ARRIVE might be the one that's the most long-standing of the things for which you're known.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, what does it stand for, just so our listeners know, just in terms of the acronym? But then I guess we could say, what does it stand for? Meaning, what is the meaning of it? What do you do here for people? What does ARRIVE do?
Well, it was originally a research study funded through the National Institute on Drug Abuse. It was the first money or dollars that the federal government applied toward HIV, the HIV epidemic, in terms of trying to find some way to stem the thousands of injecting drug users who were becoming infected and dying of HIV-related illnesses. So as many research studies do, they take the initials of their study and make an acronym out of it. So ARRIVE stood for AIDS Risk Reduction for IV Drug Users in Reentry. The specific target population was recently released parolees who were known to be injecting drug users. As Joe said, we started in a church basement with seven individuals who showed up just recently released from prison. And we were made a number of decisions before we started the program as we were creating it, because we created it from scratch. One decision was there was tremendous urgency. People were out there becoming infected and dying, and in wanting to quickly engage them, we felt we needed to create a very low threshold to make it easy for them to access our services. And we did that by telling people that they did not necessarily have to get off drugs to participate in our program. We created the first harm reduction program in the United States of America. We decided not to make sobriety or reduction in drug use a condition for acceptance into our program. The other thing that we did, based upon the target population, meaning people coming out of prison, one thing you know about people that are coming out of prison, they don't want to get involved in some open-ended process like drug treatment where you know where you begin but you don't know where it ends. So we created a process that had a clearly defined beginning, middle, and end. It consisted of 24 classes given within an 8-week period. So it basically looks like a 3 or 4 credit college course. And we thought that people seeing the beginning and middle and end up front could give us what we wanted. We wanted our participants to make a commitment. And because it had a clearly defined beginning and middle end, we figured they could commit to that. And we were right. We started with 7, cycle number 1. 5 graduated. Cycle number 2, we brought in 13, and 9 graduated. Cycle number 3, 19, along with women came in on cycle number 3, and 15 graduates graduated. So as the research study, you saw an exponential growth of the participants and graduates in the ARRIVE program. So we knew we had something good. We knew we were making a positive impact on people. But as a research study, it comes to an end. You know, they're usually for 3 years. You know, you create, you demonstrate, and then you do a final follow-up report. And Joe and I were told in the end of 1989 that the final report component of the study was going to be written, and we were supposed to shut the ARRIVE program down because there was no fundings for it to go on. And because we had graduated almost 170 people in that year and a half, and we knew we were doing something good, we had a lot of good feedback, Joe, myself, And at that time, our colleague, Maria Josepher, decided to continue to offer the ARRIVE program to the people who wanted to take it. Now, we had people coming in seeking our services, and we decided to keep it going even though we didn't get a paycheck. And so we worked for a year and a half providing the ARRIVE program without getting paid, but knowing that what we were doing was righteous, helpful, and that we were going to, sooner or later, we were going to be okay. Right. Sooner or later, we were going to get some funding to keep this important project going.
And you all at this point are still working in the basement of a church too, right? I mean, I guess maybe if you're operating on faith, it probably helps if you're working in a house of religion.
Well, we had moved by.
Well, we were in that church. We were in the basement. It was a very tiny room, and we shared the space with the homeless.
With the homeless shelter.
You know,
sometimes Howie would be teaching, and you could smell like the aroma of crack being smoked into our classroom. And Howie's trying to talk about relapse prevention, and so that dynamic. And then I think either they moved us to the gym, or we had a graduation in the gym, but we clearly outgrew the church. And the agency that was coordinating the study, NDRI, had space available in their regular training facility, and we moved there after a short while. And but I just want to say something very important, that Howie said that we worked for free because we saw the need. I mean, the agency has always been defined our funding approaches by the need. We dealt with the need first, and we sought funding afterwards. The other thing is that at the height of the AIDS epidemic in 1988, where there were no medications, and we would go up to the prisons and recruit, in the beginning men and then women, coming back home after doing bids, and you know, AIDS was, it was killing people. The gay community had organized to fight this disease, but for the substance abuse community, you know, ARRIVE was the only resource available. So we could not wait, morally, we could not wait for someone to become drug free to get our services. You know, we had a saying that, you know, dead addicts don't recover.
I've heard that before.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And just one class I remember, Howie, I think it was in cycle two, we were teaching, and one of the new participants of that cycle came in straight, you know, right from prison. He had just copped some drugs, but after a couple of classes, you know, he was very ambivalent. He took the drugs, threw them on the table, and said, "I don't want to get high anymore." So, you know, I think in hindsight that was very important. One, you know, he felt safe enough to come into our space. I think if that had happened at any other program, they would have threw him out on his ear. But we processed that and helped him along the way. You know, it was a powerful statement about harm reduction and about exponents. So that was our roots.
You mentioned that you were the original harm reduction recovery organization in the country. Was the term harm reduction then used, or was this something that you just came out of the logic of your own experience, and then later someone says, "Hey, you know, we'll just call that harm reduction"? How did that work out? It sounds like you all saw the need,
yes,
and did what you made a plan and did that, as opposed to being guided by some sort of philosophy which may or may not really have existed in 1988.
We did a lot of research when we were asked to create this program, and reading about the way they were doing drug treatment services in England, in particular Liverpool, they weren't doing harm reduction, and they had called it harm reduction. So we heard about harm reduction and the way a new way of engaging this population. And other people at that time also utilized the term harm reduction in the needle exchanges. It was a way to save lives, to give them clean syringes so that they would not become infected, and to make sure that people did not share syringes. Needle exchange was called harm reduction, and there were other people around doing that at the same time that we started ARRIVE. But where I make the distinction is, different than the syringe exchange harm reduction, we were a program. It wasn't that you just came in and got a clean needle and then went on your way. Mm. We had a process,
right.
And the process had structure and requirements. As any 3 or 4 credit college course, you're allowed 3 cuts. But if you only have 3 cuts, you can complete your course. And it was the same with us. You could miss 3 classes in ARRIVE, but if you missed 4 or 5 classes, you won't complete, you won't graduate. So we were a harm reduction process, not just a syringe exchange
process. Not just the walk-in.
And central to that, and how is it central to that, is that our participants were engaged. You know, that we had all the elements of meeting people where they are with compassion and without judgment. We had a program. We met people where they were, but we did not leave them there. I mean, the strength of the community was a therapeutic engagement where our participants, they participated, you know, in that process, in their own process. And I think that was key to what we did then and what we do now.
So what was the structure of a typical ARRIVE 8-week cycle then? Because I'm going to assume that, I mean, you said 1988 is when you began?
Yes.
Correct.
So you guys are on your 30-year anniversary.
Correct.
ARRIVE is on its 30-year anniversary next year.
Right.
So
I started working when I was 6.
Is that right? So you're...
After...
You're a 36-year-old, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Very precocious young scholar, I guess you are.
Thank you very much.
We just want to add one other important element to the idea of a new harm reduction program was the belief, and it was my belief, that the best people to do this work were people who came from the same communities and the same background and had similar experiences to the individuals that we were trying to help. So that's why we call it a community, that our staff have been in the same seat, so to speak, or the same predicaments as the people who come to the programs, and they have managed to transcend many of the issues and the problems. And so just their presence working in the program, helping us to facilitate their program, just their presence and their own experience of having overcome many of their own challenges had the ability to ignite hope in the individuals who were coming to ARRIVE. And the ignition of hope is a spiritual quality that is so important. You know, because the person who's been down and out and just getting out of prison and maybe on his way or her way to getting strung out again looks at that person and says, well, if they can do it, I can do it too. So the idea of community, using people just like Joe and me, we're both graduates of a therapeutic community program. That's why I hired Joe to begin with, because he understood the idea of community, of communicating across the board and not talking down to people. So that between the short-term intervention, not requiring sobriety to be a participant in our program, and the utilizations of individuals who've had the same experiences as the clients we are working with, I think are three critical elements of why we're still doing this 30 years later. Mm.
So both of you all were a graduate of a therapeutic community. Was it the same one? Is that how you met?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
No.
That was not how you met.
No, I went through, I'm a graduate of Phoenix House. And I graduated in 1989. Joe went through Phoenix House some years later with my brother.
Right.
And it was my brother that introduced me to Joe.
Right.
And when we met, it's like people who've gone through an experience like that. It's like a brotherhood. You know, you immediately know something about that person because they've gone through very similar experiences as let's say I have. So Joe and I connected, bonded really quickly, and the mission became our focus and our passion.
Now, was it just when the two of you met, was it immediately? It's like, hey, let's start a treatment program or a recovery program, or what's the organic process there?
Let me give you,
because you all did not know each other while in the days, you know, before you were in recovery.
No. But as Howie said, that shared experience, I mean, I was close with his brother, and his brother said, basically approached me and said, Joe, my brother Howie has just started this program, you know, it's part-time. You don't even have to do anything. Just go there. I said, okay.
And boy, did he bullshit
right,
him.
Right. So, Howie had an office on 3rd Avenue, private practice, psychotherapy practice. Went there. Howie had a toothache that day. And had this interview. And I said, who the hell is this guy? You know, I didn't even like him. But
he still doesn't like me, but you know. But I'm working on him, you know, gradually.
And you know, Howie, when I think about it, I don't even know what was I hired to do. I think to assist in the training, because I was working also with the drug education unit of Phoenix House that conducted prevention seminars in schools and other community settings. So. But when I went to work for Arrive, you know, that first, you know, that half of the cycle of classes, you know, I made coffee, I ran the video camera, and watched, you know, how he engaged these individuals that had very, you know, tortured backgrounds of incarceration and drug addiction. And when they were coming out, I'm sure some of them thought they were just coming to another program. You know, it's just another program.
Just part of the cycle.
Just part of the cycle.
In and out of the cycle, yeah.
And that they would go through the motions. But, boy, were they in for a surprise. You know, they became engaged. And not only did they become engaged, I became engaged. And I fell in love with what we're doing.
Well, what he did was really smart. He came in and he observed. This was radically different than anything that we had known about the idea of working with substance users without focusing on their substance use.
Right.
It's how they use. It's not to tell them don't use. It's how to use more safely, how to use where you can, you know, take care of yourself and your loved ones and your family. So Joe was watching what this processes were about, and we were all learning as we were going. But the idea of a harm reduction approach, low threshold, in the midst of an epidemic where tens of thousands of drug users were becoming infected and dying, and they were dying right in front of your face. You could look at somebody one day, he's coming to your program, he's fine, he's active, and within no time, the wasting syndrome sets in where the person starts to lose flesh, and they look gaunt, and they look sick, and they're gone. One of the interesting things that happened at that time also was we started to notice that many of the individuals were coming
were smoking marijuana, and they were doing so for a medical purpose. They were smoking marijuana so they could have an appetite, so they could eat to keep weight on. What else we saw was the marijuana helped them to show up for the classes. So
it just as a kind of as a mood relaxant,
exactly.
Just kind of, yeah, just to be able to just to kind of calm down and like deal with the anxiety of everything going on in your life.
And we had, you know, based upon some of my own journey and my own spiritual quest, we came to understand that if we could help people to stay in the moment, stay present, because the individuals we were working with, they didn't necessarily have a future. They, you know, people didn't want to get tested in those days because a HIV positive result was looked at as a death sentence.
Yeah.
So our message of staying present, paying attention, stay in the moment, it resonated with the people coming to our program. And I mean, whether you have a life-threatening illness or not, I think the idea of paying attention, staying in the moment, which is called reality, is a very good idea. So people were very receptive to our messages.
Well, you know, I mean, it's, I mean, not funny, but I mean, it's interesting that you bring it up because today, you know, there's everyone's talking about mindfulness, which it sounds like that's what you're talking
absolutely.
About. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, and it's actually, mindfulness has made its way into yes. recovery. Like
yes.
you know, like there's people who. I mean, you guys apparently were 25 years ahead of the
yes.
ahead of the curve on that.
Well, let me just say that mindfulness in the East, in India, has another name, but it's the same idea. It's called witness consciousness.
Hmm.
Mindfulness is you are witnessing your own thoughts and your own feelings. And so if you can witness your thoughts, witness your feelings, then you are not your thoughts and feelings. There's another level of consciousness in us. It's a higher consciousness. And we're just trying to bring people to that awareness, whether they can practice it or not. We hope so. But that awareness, that all that yama, yama, yama going on in your mind, and all those feelings that you got, that if you can observe that, that means you're not that.
Right. Right.
That's a lot for when you're talking about a population that chances yes. are has been dealing with trauma,
right.
probably a good amount of abuse, psychological abuse. So that, yeah. that yama 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 you're talking about, that those demons in the head are always
exactly.
they're
and,
always
right.
yelling. There's a
right.
lot of noise going on.
And going to programs, going there to be fixed by the program, you know, you know that there's some magic, there's some type of repair that's going to go on and someone's not going to shoot dope anymore. And here we are saying that you can manage your feelings. If you can manage your thoughts, then you can manage your actions.
So you were talking about the programs that were then in existence were the ones that were
absolutely.
Trying to, that
absolutely.
They were enforcing the sobriety, the abstinence
right.
model.
Right. So and, mindfulness yeah. had no place in those traditional abstinence-based programs. You know, even spirituality. I remember when I was in Phoenix House that a guy came in. Well, this is religion. A guy came in, a new jack, 2 days in a bunk, and he's reading a Bible. The counselor comes in and says, "What the hell are you doing?" He says, "I'm reading a Bible." He says, "Look, you weren't shooting Bibles out there. You were shooting dope." He said, "Put that shit away." He got a contract.
Right.
So, jeez. You know, we introduce that concept that we are not, you know, enslaved to our feelings and to our thoughts, that we have to respond every single time with a needle in our arm. And this was revolutionary.
Now, was this the original ARRIVE model? It was 8 weeks, right? And it still is, right?
Correct, yeah.
yeah. So what does the curriculum look like on this then? Like, how do, because it's... Like, you know, today, like, you can take courses in, you know, in social work school or a master's in psychology about mindfulness and addiction.
Yeah.
Like, it's all institutionalized at this point. And I don't mean that necessarily in a bad way. I mean, it's there if you want to learn it. But you guys are building the plane as you fly it. So how do two of you all, recent alums from Phoenix House, mm-hmm. just met each other, not even sure if you like each other, apparently, decide, like, how do you make, what's week one, what's week two?
We're still not sure, Sam.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, how does it work out?
Well, we had professional input in developing the course. Yeah. And one of the things, you know, when you start a training is you do getting acquainted activities. So things like we had the name game, like everybody in the classroom would have to stand up and not only say their name, but proceed saying their name with some adjective like, "Hi, guys, I'm Hot Howie." And then we say to the person, "Well, tell us why you chose the name Hot." Well, for me, it was a distant memory. There was a time I thought I was a pretty hot dude. But you see, there's a little bit of a lightheartedness in this, and it's called icebreaking. And so the first week had a lot of icebreaking and establishment of the norms, what was expected of people. But that we did have interactive exercises as part of that getting acquainted and showing, demonstrating to the participants what to expect in the following weeks.
And we made them feel at home too, Howie. Remember, we would ask them the first class their name, I think where they were from, something about their recovery. And we always would preface it with, "Hey, look, you know, this is a special club. We just don't let anybody in here. Like, what dig taxes were you in? You know, we're going to check your references. You know? What prisons did you go to?"
So, what corner?
What corner? All right, you can get in.
But that brings up a point. I mean, because, you know, everyone's recovery is their own path, right? Whereas, I mean, a lot of programs, I mean, I think even today, but certainly back then, it was a kind of one-size-fits-all approach.
One-size-fits-all.
So in bringing out people, when you say, "Tell us something about your recovery," it's like, this part of the narrative process where people are encouraged to, like, think, reflect upon, how did I get here? You know, where am I now?
And eventually they will know through ARRIVE that those experiences, both painful and good, have value. You know, they now can be assets in you relating to someone else who's also walking that path, that everything that we've been to has built up some capital in recovery that can be used for our good and someone else's good.
But you know, there was something, and it's an important distinction in something that Joe and I brought that is really unique. We're both recovering drug addicts. Joe, I'm going to disclose, is a sober recovering drug addict. I am not a sober recovering drug addict, but we could work together and we can create something vital and important and beautiful together. A lot of people don't know, but that in the early days, the very beginning in the late 60s of the therapeutic communities, the outcome of the program was not a sober recovery. The participants in the early Phoenix House, Daytops, Odyssey House, at the final phase of the program were given what we call drinking privileges. That they were still in the program, but it was okay for them to drink. Now, if a problem arose, you saw some acting out, they're still in the program, so it could be addressed. But the outcome of the program was to become a responsible member of society, not necessarily a sober member of society. So I represented one kind of recovery, Joe represented another kind of recovery, but we worked so well together that we said, "Listen, there's different ways you could do this. There's different ways, you know, you can have a future." And we modeled that for them. And we're still doing that now, all of these years later. With Joe and I, we do similar kind of work, but how we practice our personal lifestyles is our choice, and I think both choices are working really well for both of us.
Right, and that choice we offer to our participants. You know, that, you know, many roads to recovery, you know, that we give them and respect their choices to pursue their pathway.
That's unique, recovery. That people have that choice. That one, yeah. That one size fits all had a one size fits all outcome.
Right.
Right. Which means if you don't fit into it, then you kind of not part of the model then.
Right. But the important thing about that is, and why the therapeutic communities changed, is that they found that the missing element in terms of the success of these treatment facilities, the missing element was after people completed the program, they lost all support. The only support out there in the community for people with drug or alcohol issues was 12-step meetings. And so the programs, in order to fit that model, the 12-step model, changed their own model to be more in line with 12-step and the sober recovery. So,
Howie, I'm glad you brought that up because you and I, you know, we've talked a lot about your program, and I actually knew about your program through graduates whom I knew. So I feel like I know a bit. It's always struck me that certain aspects of the ARRIVE model seem to take some of the better aspects of the 12-step, which is the kind of group camaraderie.
That's right.
The mutual support. The
community.
Community part, but discarding. I mean, you talk to anyone in 12-step, they'll say, yeah, it's, like, it's all about the people who are there. The people are the program. But it seems like you've also been able to discard those things which you find not really appropriate for the mission that you've set before yourselves, which is to say that emphasis on sobriety and
right.
abstinence at all
right.
times, that emphasis on, you know, relapse means failure. Whereas, Joe, you said something earlier about, you know, each failure, I don't even think failure was the word that you used, but is a learning opportunity.
Yes, absolutely.
Where that's not really the case in a lot of programs, that it's called a relapse.
It's called a relapse.
Relapse is a negative word, yeah. Top to bottom.
It connotes failure. We also took the best elements out of the therapeutic communities. You know, and I think for that was that word community, you know, that we're all involved in this process. This process, you know, produces individuals with a certain bond that can not only change the individual, you know, but also has an effect on the family, an effect on the community at large. You met many graduates. The times are countless that Howie and I can walk down the street and you'll hear a voice, Howie, Joe.
Arrive, cycle 137.
Right. Yeah, I was in San Francisco on a conference. San Francisco, walking down, trying to get to Chinatown, hungry, and I hit Joe Turner. And, you know, I'm from Brooklyn, so I turn around slow, like, you know, I mean, do I owe you money? So, and it was somebody from cycle whatever. And people, we have, I think, Howie, we have graduates that are executive directors of agencies now that are professionals in the field, and they all hold on to that ARRIVE identity.
That was actually my next question, because the name of the organization, Exponents, as I understand it, comes from the literal exponential growth of the community itself. So you graduate, you know, a group of 11 people.
Yes.
But they go out and ultimately affect a few others themselves, and et cetera, et cetera. So I wanted to ask you I don't know if you can literally measure the influence, but I mean, what are some of the indicators that you have? You said that you have people who have graduated now have started their own programs.
Yes.
Which I imagine are in some ways based on the ARRIVE model. Like, what's the scene? Because you all are, I mean, Exponents, you all don't have any a site outside of New York, right? It's just New York.
Just New York.
But your graduates, I assume, haven't all stayed in New York. They're probably all over the world.
Throughout
right?
the world.
Yeah, so what are some of them doing, just as examples?
Well, some have pursued careers in public health. May not have started their own programs, but are working for renowned health agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Some have have stayed in the field of substance use treatment and recovery. The paths are so varied. time, but I think the connective tissue is what they've learned about from Arrive, from Exponents, to allow them to believe in themselves and to manifest that. I think if you looked at them when they first came in, that first class, you know, people were saying, well, what can I get out of this? You know, there's an element of distrust. And week by week, that sort of melts away. So after graduation, we encourage them. I said, look, you completed this. This was, you know when it started, and you'll know when it ends. Go on to other programs. And invariably, they stay in touch with us as they make their way through education, through their career paths. So there is that connection with them. But they're all over the world.
So eight weeks is in the life of or the career of recovery, 8 weeks is a really short time, right? I mean, recovery, I mean, depends on whom you ask, right? Recovery could be a couple of years or, you know, I've known a lot of people who say it's a lifetime endeavor. So do you find yourself, the people who come to you, what, I know there's no typical, like no, you know, kind of what is the average or whatever, but are you getting people who are, what stage in their recovery are they? Are they at the beginning? Or are they at a point where they've been thinking about recovery? Maybe they've tried a bunch of other programs and they said, you know what, like that didn't work, but I learned something from a bad experience or an unproductive experience.
Or they're still getting high.
Yeah, I mean, like everybody's recovery is going to feature parts where whatever they're trying to do, they fail at some point. Yeah. Call it failure or relapse or whatever. So are you getting people who are... I don't know the question I'm asking, yeah, but yeah, what mindset are people in when they come to your door?
Well, first I would say, how do they get to the door? And most of them get to the door having spoken to a graduate. Most of our referrals come through word of mouth, and that has been our reputation, and to this day, that is how people hear about us. We're still a relatively small organization, which also is a good thing because our services can be personalized. We can get me, I'm the head honcho, but I'm in teaching a number of classes. I'm working with my staff in supervision. I'm very involved. But the key is that it is a brief intervention, but it can have a profound impact on the people who come here. And then they talk to others and then more people. That's where the referrals come from. No one, and this is something we're very proud of, in the 30-year history, with more than 10,600 graduates, not one person has ever been mandated or referred by the criminal justice system. Every single person that came here voluntarily, sat in that chair 21 to 24 classes. And there was a number of activities that they had to do over the course of that time that were truly challenging, like getting up in front of a room and making a presentation. Like speaking up, like being in small groups, because we break the big groups into small groups to give people more individualized attention. So, yeah, some people can get lost, but that doesn't mean they're not learning. That don't mean they're not picking up. I mean, when I say some people can get lost, they may participate to different levels than others.
Yeah.
But
and actually, that wasn't really. I mean, I wasn't necessarily going that direction. I wasn't trying to ask about, you know, who quote unquote drops out of the program and gets lost in the program. I'm really just in terms of, you know, when people are on that recovery journey, it seems I was trying to figure out how it is that they decide, like, that they make that step where they want to sit, where they say, I'm going to come to Exponents. But it sounds like it's the word of mouth.
That's where they
say, you know, I tried A, I tried B, I tried C, I tried D. And they have a friend who said, yeah, I tried all those plus F, G, H, and I, but what worked for me was Exponents. You should check them out.
And it's not to say that those previous treatment experiences or recovery experience or participation meaning had no meaning. You know, it's an evolving process. When is a person, you know, reach that point where they're really ready to do things differently. And so, yeah,
I wanted to say, at what stage of recovery do they come in? I think we've had people that are still continuing to use drugs. But I think it says something not just about exponents, but about them, that they would get high and choose to come here instead of staying home, you know, listening, and instead of staying in some other environment. That I think that they're being engaged even while they're getting high. I think one of the best tools we use is that we watch our language and our lexicon. We don't use the word clean or dirty, you know, that they are here and we accept them just as they are. And we do it without blame and we do it without judgment. So
I assume the word addict is also jettisoned from the lexicon as well.
Right.
Yeah, you don't... I don't know. Do you all, maybe you all do use the word addict around here. I must say that I do.
Well, he's it's an all time.
Yeah, actually, yeah. I've heard you describe yourself as
Sam.
I'm a junkie.
I'm an old time dope fiend.
Dope fiend, yes. I always like the word.
If you're going to go down that road, let's go down that road.
Dope fiend sounds slick. Junkie, no.
So the, I forgot what I was about to add. Oh, yeah, so Joe, you said as a measure of
engagement.
Of engagement that people could still be using and still show up.
Yes.
Now, there's going to be people listening to this. Mm-hmm. We're going to have some people who are not exposed to that line of thought who around this moment in the podcast are about to turn it off and say, what the hell? Like, I thought the whole point of recovery was not to use drugs. Where are you going with that when you say that it's an encouraging sign to see someone who's still using but still shows up to the program?
Yes.
Does that see the question that I'm saying?
I'm sure
people have asked you this question all the time.
Right. It makes sense, but I also want to turn it over to Howie with this one preface that we've always felt that drug use was a symptom of something else going on deeper. That was the manifestation. So that's why we never focused on clean urines or the cessation of using drugs, but looked deeper into what is going on with that person. And Howie has a theory about that as well.
Theory is that people take drugs is a form of self-medication. So the question is, what are they medicating?
Right.
So to use a shorthand, people are medicating their pain. So let's teach people other ways of coping, how they can reduce stress, how they can take better care of themselves in terms of their overall health and wellness. So we engaged people not on so much on their drug use, but on health, wellness, and mental health issues. They're critical. And we think we're dealing with the root of the problem, not the symptom. And so that's basically the way we're been going about it, and we'll keep going about it, is that people are hurting. And we need to teach them ways to self-manage the many conditions, both health and mental health conditions, that they have.
And what are some of the techniques that you've developed over the past 3 decades? I think before we started talking, before we started the recording anyway, how you mentioned meditation, and I think you said yoga. As part of it, you all are hoping you all are moving out of this building, I hear, to something a lot larger, right?
Yes.
So,
yes.
I think Howie said you guys want to open up a discotheque and
yes.
Okay, disco. Just for the record, no, he didn't say disco.
Two discotheques
and a rollerblading rink. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, I think I did hear you say a meditation studio and a yoga studio. Like
there's a lot of. Let's call it complementary and alternative medicine. There's a lot of exercises that can benefit people if they learn about it and then they have the option to practice it. And so that's what we do. We teach people self-management skills. I can break them down. Meditation is one. There are other stress reduction mechanisms or techniques that we can teach. We do a lot of dancing here. So this self-management is just providing people with the tools to take better care of themselves. We don't get caught up in whether they use the tools or not. Mm. Our job is to teach, to show them these, teach them these tools. Whether they use it or not is up to them. So we're not coercing anybody. We're not forcing. We're putting it out there. I like to think we're singing our song. Other people hear it. They say, hey, that's cool. I'm going with that. And that's up to them. We don't feel a failure. We're not failures if people don't change. We want people to change. We hope they get better. But that's not how we base whether we're doing our job or not. We're just singing our song. We're putting this information out there. And let people do and go with it the way they want.
And in terms of outcomes, and you're a scientist, Sam, so we look at their lifestyles and the quality of their lives, having gone through exponents. And, you know, even SAMHSA these days is not defining recovery. I don't think the word drug use is nowhere to be found in that definition.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that until I think a couple months ago I read the new SAMHSA definition of recovery.
Absolutely. They're talking about wellness. Holistic concepts of wellness, a self-directed life.
I did a word search on it. I think the word abstinence or some version of abstinence shows up maybe twice in the whole document.
Right.
And it's like, and when they say so, they say, if you want to be abstinent, you know, that's part of the recovery. But they're not mandating abstinence the way it would have been.
And I hope they're providing choice, just as we have since 1988.
Well, I don't think it's really filtered down. I think that one size fits all is still dominant in the addiction treatment world.
Well, you know, Howie, that brings me to what do you think is, as someone who's been in the field for, you know, 30 plus years now, and who have established themselves as leaders in the recovery field, if we could call it that, what do you think is the near term, or if you want to even go like long term future of recovery in, we could start with the United States, but if you have like global or international perspectives, we could talk about those too. Where do you think we're going?
Well, where I would like to see us go, and we do see that it is going in that way, that that we have to be able to offer someone who needs help more options. We have to offer both traditional treatment, sober type programs, and harm reduction programs. It hasn't happened yet. We're still running into tremendous resistance around harm reduction. New York State has not moved to the extent that we would like it to move. We know they're talking about doing more harm reduction work in terms of safe injection facilities, but clinically they're not seeking out programs like ours to expand the treatment option open to people. So
this is New York State.
This is New York State. This is still a lot of parochialism in New York State, an unwillingness to shift, even in the face of a horrendous epidemic of overdoses and deaths, that we're still doing things the way we've been doing them for the last 30 or 40 years. And that is just shameful. And as proud as I am of what we've brought forth and the work that we're doing, and the excitement that comes from people who now seeing new ways of working, engaging with substance use, we're still seeing a state that that cannot move forward.
Right.
And that is really depressing.
And I agree with Howie. I mean, and we experience that like balkanization firsthand between, you know, with the interests of people in prevention, then those have certain interests in working in treatment, and now even in recovery. Sometimes the walls are up.
Mm.
And the funding for those three types of engagements also is dispersed, basically still on an abstinence and bureaucratic, a paralyzed bureaucratic model statewide. So the funds are dripped out, and so this central, you know, the centralized coordination of drug use treatment causes problems in itself. But I wanted to say one thing also. Mm. where I see things going, where I'd like to see them to go as well. I mean, harm reduction is central as to who we are. That's in our DNA. Many harm reduction agencies out there, but I believe that we also need to look at some type of reparative notions of recovery. Mm. And of course, we're dealing with the individual here. You know, we're dealing with some of the injury and the harm. We're trying to reduce the harm that people do to themselves. But I believe that it must go further and look into notions of harm repair, as we talked about, that
yeah.
we need to begin to repair. Now, how do you repair someone who's shot dope for 30 years and has been in and out of prison, and you know, some of those effects of leading this type of life now? Just, I think we can do that by looking at and providing individuals with the resources to facilitate that repair. Employment, right? Adequate housing. You know, looking at a well-directed life. And I think that would also then have an effect on his family or her family. And then going on to the community, some of the harms that the community has inflicted on this person. You know, from racism and sexism, police misconduct, you know, unemployment, those types of activities. I think we can extend it further towards reparative therapy with some of those ills as well.
That is an advanced step, given the current political moments. I absolutely agree with you.
We're still basking in the glow of the victory in Alabama yesterday. So
I guess anything is possible, right? Yeah, right. Yeah. That is true. Yeah.
And isn't it amazing the role that Black women played? And that I've some of the stats coming out now that it was a massive Black turnout. I'll tell Jeff Garrell that. It was a massive Black turnout. But 98% of the Black women voted for Doug Jones. And more, and Black women voted, I think, 2-1 than Black men. So they're really important.
Just for our listeners, today is the 13th? December the 13th,
yes.
2017, yesterday was a special election senatorial in Alabama featuring Republican Roy Moore versus Democrat Doug Jones. And Jones squeaked it by, and largely because he had the support, as you were saying, Joe, of Black women. Just as an aside, the question is, does the Democratic Party, will they recognize that and remember that when, you know, moving forward? Because it's really the jury is not in that the Democrats are really invested in grassroots community power. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, it's still...
Yeah.
You know, let's see how many Black candidates are going to try to run in the South and in the Midwest as well and give them real support.
Yeah.
I mean, I got nothing against Doug Jones at all, but I think his, like, quote-unquote civil rights credentials were a little bit overblown. Mm-hmm. I think that, I guess what I'm saying, Joe, the next move is we need to run some Black women.
Yeah.
down there.
Right.
And not just rely on them to vote, but we need to rely on them to hold the office.
Absolutely. And this type of contribution to society, we've been doing in Exponents as well. We've had a program that encouraged folks to see themselves beyond their present circumstances and to get involved with issues beyond their own personal interests. You know, if you look at addiction as a totally self-centered disease, you know, totally self-centered focus, I'm going to get high at the expense of my family, myself, everything else.
Yeah.
Then maybe, just maybe, the therapy for that, instead of self-centeredness, is a selflessness, an advocacy for issues other than your own personal ones. In Exponents, we have mobilized years back against the draconian drug laws, the Rockefeller drug law in particular, mandatory minimums. We had demonstrations. Howie led countless demonstrations against issues, and we were the only substance abuse program out there.
Advocacy.
So that's also central to us as well. So
that was a unique thing for a drug program to do, to advocate for to mobilize participants in our program to advocate for issues that are important to them and to their communities. It wasn't to advocate for our drug program.
Right.
To advocate for the issues that are impacting lives. And that had not been done before. Previous advocacy done by drug programs were for drug program funding.
Yes.
So they were the advocates were brought out and brought to, in this state, brought to Albany to advocate for funding for the programs. Our advocacy initiatives were for issues, various issues, like clean needles, getting rid of the mandatory minimums, making sure that our own city Department of Health, when it was getting federal funding to stop the HIV epidemic, that money was dispersed to where the epidemic was happening. It wasn't just happening in the gay community, it was happening in poorer communities, in substance using communities, and they weren't distributing the funding equitably. And we had to get out there and fight for it. And we did. Mm. So the wonderful thing that we saw was when our participants would go to a state legislator's office and speak about what they felt was important, and then they came out and they said, wow, that guy listened to me. They heard what I had to say. They would come away, our participants would come away from advocacy initiatives feeling good about themselves. And anytime you can build self-esteem in people who we work with, you're doing a good job.
It sounds like there's a common thread here. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think we in society separate recovery from harm reduction, right? A lot of people think of harm reduction as, in the literal sense, reducing the harm, kind of say, we know you're going to do this thing anyway, so let's just try to make it safer for you, et cetera, et cetera. And then recovery is when, okay, so you've decided not to do those things anymore, right? It sounds like you all are making a continuity between what you envision recovery to be and what you want harm reduction to be. So, Joe, you said harm reparation in the sense that it sounds to me like you were making a challenge to those of us in harm reduction and say we need to think beyond just reducing the harm and think about in a macro social structural way about how are these harms, you know, like we can, harm reduction needs to talk less about harms that people are self-inflicting, but also the harms maybe that society is inflicting upon people.
Right, and unless we address those conditions, environmental, sociological, as well as political, as well as we address those forces that inflict harm and give those participants the resources, you know, to deal with those harms, then I think we're only adding to this revolving door. And not empowering people, I don't even want to use the word empower, but not availing people of the opportunity to fully lead lives, self-directed lives, and participate in this wonderful world of ours.
Now, what's wrong with empower, if you don't mind me asking? You said you don't want to use the word empower. What?
Well, we've always felt that people have this power within, maybe an untapped self-actualization that can permit. It's not that we're not putting something in them. We're not saying, bang, you're empowered. But that awakening, that aha that happens in exponents, where someone says, okay, I want to transform my life. It's self-transformative. We provide the environment. You know, we provide the acceptance and the love and the community and the advocacy. But that is something that happens within them.
I'll be honest with you. I think I've used the word empower and probably thought about it in that literal sense all the time. Never really thought about it. I like the way you flipped that around. All right. Thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate it. Before we go, do you have any last words or advice for anybody listening, for our listening audience?
I'll give you a kind of organizational philosophy that we've had since we began this work, is take what you do seriously, take yourself lightly. You got to be able to laugh at yourself, because I'll just stay with those of us who became addicted, possibly criminals, and saw the darker side of life. We're serious people, and we just wanted to teach people, you know, just you gotta learn how to lighten up and put things into a perspective that it doesn't overwhelm you and doesn't cause you more pain and more grief, which is going to lead to more need to self-medicate. You gotta laugh at yourself. And we try to demonstrate that too, because Joe and I are always poking fun at each other in front of our students. You know, we're in the end of the day, we're just humans. It's all we are. And in truth, that's the answer to recovery, which is self-acceptance, and to accept oneself as a human, not as perfect, not as powerful, but just as a human being that has strengths and weaknesses, long suits and short suits, good qualities, not so good qualities. That's the only way a person is going to feel comfortable in their own skin, by how they, you know, how they can see, you know, the good and the not so good, and take those contradictions and put it into a whole.
It sums it up.
Yeah, I was about to say, Joe, do you want to try to follow on that one?
Or? I am with him all the way. But I do want to end on one of Howie's quotes that has helped me over the years in this journey. He would say in class early on, he would say, angels can fly because they take themselves lightly. It is so true. I mean, but I want to end.
We put it on our T-shirts.
We put it on our T-shirts. I want to end on just the power of that last statement of Howie. I have nothing to add or take away from that, but that's great.
All right. Sounds good. Mm-hmm. Guys, thank you so much. Enjoyed this. Really appreciate you guys taking the time out. And more importantly, thank you for the work that you guys have been doing for 30 plus years now.
Well, thank you for the opportunity for sharing it.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Sam.
All right. You guys take care. Thank you.
All right, Doc. Okay.
Okay, folks. That was my conversation with Howard Josepher and Joe Turner, the co-founders of Exponents, the country's oldest harm reduction recovery organization. We barely covered all the things that they do at Exponents, so please check out their website, which is www.exponents.org. That is EXPONENTS.org for more information about their programs. You can follow them on Twitter at Exponents Inc. They're also on Facebook. Our contact information, find us at our website, www.pdinterestingstuff.com.
please email your feedback, constructive critique, moral support to us at pdinterestingstuff@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at SKRPDIS or me personally at Samuel K. Roberts. Thank yous to Zoraida Lopez, our technical advisor. My opening sign-on was with my little brother, Franklin Roberts. In fact, Frank is PDIS's biggest fan. We've been through thick and thin together. He got me through grad school years and years ago. And 3 years ago, we got each other through the passing of our father. Love you, Frank. Thanks so much. Pop, we love you. We miss you every day. But we're doing okay down here. PDIS's intro music on this episode was written and performed by my brother-in-law, Kabari Garrett. By the way, thanks to my little bro, Franklin Roberts, who recorded Gabari at a studio in Richmond, Virginia. Outro music is by Brandon Harris and Franklin Roberts of Harris and Roberts Music. Check out more of what they do at www.harrisandroberts.com. Thank you, of course, to my good friends at the Columbia University Center for Science and Society, who offered material and moral support. Keep your eyes open for more people doing interesting stuff. I'm Samuel Roberts. Thanks for listening.